This broadcast of Irish Radio Hour from Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, is paid for by Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to This Irish American Life, coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan Gray, and I am your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Glucksman Ireland House is New York University's Centre for the Study of Ireland and the Irish Diaspora. It was founded in 1993 by Loretta Brennan Glucksman and her late husband, Louis L. Glucksman. We teach, research, archive, provide public programmes, and generally educate our community on the Irish experience at home and abroad. We come to you every week from our home on Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. On this week's This Irish American Life, I'm sharing two interviews with two very interesting women. The first is with Kim Bendheim. Kim has most recently published The Fascination of What's Difficult, A Life of Maud Gonne. It's published by O.R. Books, and I'm looking forward to that interview with Kim. After my chat with Kim, I'm digging into the archives and I'm sharing a really interesting interview I conducted in 2015 with historian Dr. Una Ní Bhromhail from Mary Immaculate College in Limerick on her research on the fascinating John Quinn. Enjoy, folks. I'm delighted to welcome to This Irish American Life Kim Bendheim. Kim is a poet, performer and writer. Her byline has appeared in The Forward, The Nation, The Chicago Tribune, Ladies Home Journal, The New York Times, The Los Angeles Times, and Bomb Magazine, which published her poetry. A cum laude graduate of Harvard University, she's received two master's degrees, one from NYU, where she studied Irish literature and history, and one from the City College of New York, where she studied poetry. Kim lives in New York City. The reason we're speaking to her today, and first of all, Kim, welcome to This Irish American Life. It's really lovely to have you on with us this morning.
Yes, thank you.
And congratulations. The reason the opportunity has presented itself in the context of Kim publishing The Fascination of What's Difficult, A Life of Maud Gonne, published by O.R. Books. How does it feel, Kim, to be at this point in the process? I know this has been a labor of love for you. Can I just ask you in the first instance, how does it feel to have this book out in the world?
Great.
Good.
And then I can start thinking about what I want to do next.
Oh, very good. That's always the I'm the exact same. When I finish one project, it's on to the next. So you've obviously a busy mind. It's a wonderful read, Kim. As I mentioned to you, I'm so enjoying it. Learning. I feel like Maud Gonne is such a remarkable, fascinating figure. And on one level, we feel like we know everything about her, and as your book brings out, there's so much there. For those of our listeners to This Irish American Life who may not know who Maud Gonne is, can you tell us about who she was, why she was significant, and how you embarked on this journey to study her?
Who she was an Irish nationalist who is beloved in Ireland, but not known very well outside of the country. She campaigned for the rights of political prisoners in British jails, and she also campaigned for the rights of the evicted to have a home and food. But she's mostly remembered as being Yeats's muse because he proposed to her four times. And the last time she said no, he proposed to her daughter, and she said no, too. So she inspired him to write poetry to and about her for 38 years. And they were of the same mind about the importance of cultivating Irish culture, a distinct from England's. And then one other thing, she worked for the early amnesty associations, and then her son actually went on to be a co-founder of Amnesty International. They were very concerned with human rights.
So you mention, Kim, quite rightly, that she's often talked about in the context of W.B. Yeats, of course, but it seems that in The Fascination of What's Difficult, A Life of Maud Gonne, you're going out of your way, in a sense, to uncouple her a little bit from the narrative of her only in the context of Yeats, right? Can you explain your thought process behind that?
Well, I mean, Yeats portrayed her in one very specific way as a love object, you know, as Leda the Swan or Helen of Troy, or as a goddess. And I wanted to show that she may have been those things to Yeats, but she was also a complicated, full-fleshed character. And I wanted to be able to show her in the round, so to speak, from different angles.
You start with the beginning of her life story. You follow a kind of chronological approach, Kim, very nicely. Tell us about this kind of unlikely Irish figure. She's so associated with Ireland, but she comes from, by the context of ordinary Irish people of her times, she's from a very elite and privileged background. Can you tell us a little bit about her background and where she comes into this Irish story?
Well, she was actually English. Her father and mother were both born in England, and I think she claimed one Irish great-grandparent, and then on the basis of that, she said that she was Irish. But really, she was great-hearted, and even though her grandfather was one of the richest men in England at the height of empire, she empathized with the plight of the poor Irish she saw, because her father was stationed in the army there, and his little family was in Ireland. So she grew up seeing sights that must have been very upsetting.
And it seems like some of those sights she saw of poverty, or maybe perhaps I'm remembering as an eviction, had a profound impact on her.
Yes. She lost her mother when she was only 5. And as an old woman, when she was being interviewed on TV, she connects the loss of her mother to the Irish loss of their home. She empathized. Because she knew what it was like to be, you know, thrown out of a safe place.
You refer to, maybe to go back to yourself a little bit in terms of how the book came about, Kim, you refer to this in the book as a 25-year obsession. Can you tell us about, and I mentioned in the introduction, that you studied at Harvard, you studied at NYU and elsewhere. Where did you first come into contact with this remarkable historical figure?
Well, I was living in LA, trying to make it as an actress and as a writer. And I was writing a bunch of interviews for different newspapers there. And one of them asked me to write a review of the Gonne Yeats letters. And that really hooked me in, because she had such a powerful, distinct voice, even on the page, that I wanted to know much more about her. Aside from Yeats saying she's a beautiful woman, she's a goddess, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm. And so that was a number of years ago, Kim.
Yes. And then I love Ireland. I don't know why. You know, I'm a third generation New Yorker and Jewish. But I loved going to Ireland. And when I went, after I had read the Gagnier's letters, I met someone. Ireland is so small. You meet people right away. I met a lighting designer and his wife, and she was friends with Tiernan McBride, the deceased brother of Anna McBride White, who edited these letters. So the next thing I knew, I met Anna White and was having tea with her and her husband in her garden, and she was telling me her reminiscences with her grandmother, because she grew up with Maud in the house.
Wow. Wow. Amazing. So you seem, and you get that in the book, you convey that very well, Kim, in terms of the significance of being able to reach into history in that way through the ancestors.
Yes.
I think you're going to read for us, and I think in what you're going to read, Kim, it will contextualize. Paris is a very important place for Maud Gonne, and she spends a lot of time there, and maybe more significantly in ways it represents a place where she has a degree of freedom or mobility or a way of kind of presenting herself that wouldn't have been the same in Dublin or London of the same era for her. Can you, would you like to read from the book?
I'd love to. This is chapter 4, A Not So Immaculate Conception, Single Motherhood in Belle Époque Paris. Maud made as big a splash in Paris as she had among the group of Irish nationalist men in Dublin. Why did she use Paris as a home base? For almost 30 years, 1890 to 1918, during the Belle Époque, instead of Dublin or London, the answer is simple. It was safer for an unwed mother than the other cities, where the disapproving censure of society would have been crippling. No one would have come to Maud's late-night politing sessions in her apartment above a bookstore in Dublin if they knew she'd had a child out of wedlock. She would have been labeled a wicked, immoral woman. In contemporary London, as in Dublin, she would have been shunned. Instead, in Paris, she rented apartments on beautiful wide boulevards at 66th Avenue de la Grande Armée, then at 7th Avenue de Lieu, both within sight of the just-completed Eiffel Tower. She traveled between Paris, London, Dublin, and the Irish countryside and folded in 3 lecture tours of the United States. After her voyages by train, boat, and horseback when she was young, Paris was the place she always returned. Her children were born there. It's the place where they were raised by friends, relatives, caregivers, and Maud herself. Paris during the Belle Époque was an amazing place to live. The period lasted from 1871, the end of the Franco-Prussian War, to the start of the First World War in 1914. During those 43 years of peace, the artistic life of the city flowered. Henri Matisse, Pierre-Auguste Renoir, Camille Pissarro, Claude Debussy, Eric Satie, Sarah Bernhardt, and Marcel Proust lived in Paris. Much of Proust's enduring masterpiece, À la recherche du temps perdu, was written during the Belle Époque in Paris. Married in 1895, the brilliant scientists Marie and Pierre Curie, who together discovered radioactivity, labored, loved, lived, and died in Paris. The radical politician Georges Clemenceau also lived there, where he went from being mayor of the city to prime minister of the entire country. Colette, the sensuous bisexual writer and performer who made Maud's clandestine life look positively sedate, was another luminary who lived in Paris from 1893, apart from a few years spent touring in music halls with her cross-dressing partner, Mathilde de Mornay, known as Missy, until her death in 1954, a year after Maud. La Belle Epoque was a period of immense population growth and eye-catching new construction. The iron lattice work of the Eiffel Tower, the Paris Metro, the city's underground lifeline, and the Paris Opera, one of the loveliest opera houses in all of Europe, were built and finished during this period. When it was completed in 1889, the Eiffel Tower was the tallest man-made structure in the world. It had been engineered, designed, and built entirely by Frenchmen. Millions came to visit the beautiful city of Paris with its many cheerful window boxes and glorious flower markets during the World's Fairs of 1889 and 1900. In 30 years, the population of Paris almost doubled, reaching 2.8 million in 1911, half a million higher than it is today. In 1890 to 1891, when Maud took her first apartment in Paris, it was the most cosmopolitan of European cities, the most sophisticated, and arguably the loosest in its morals, as Maud must have realized.
Wow, that's great, Kim. Thank you for reading from it. It always brings so much life to an interview to hear the author read themselves. Thank you for that. To bring her closer to home, perhaps for listeners to this Irish-American life, she embarks on some tours to the United States. Can you tell us a little bit about them, Kim?
She was on three tours to the U.S., and she was trying to raise money for the Amnesty Associations. There were a bunch of Irish and Irish-American prisoners in jail in Britain. They were called the Treason Felony Men. And she was trying to raise money to appeal their imprisonment and give them a better standard of living in prison, because then you could only have a visitor every 3 months if you were one of these men. And the visit was only supposed to last 20 minutes. So it was very inhumane. And that was one of the causes she raised money for. Also to raise money to build a glorious Wolfe Tone Memorial. She idealized him because he had partnered with the French to try and overthrow the British colonial government in Ireland. It didn't work, but she celebrated it.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a sense as to how she viewed America or Irish America at all, Kim? Have you any sense of that?
Well, she thought America was, a brilliant place for Irish to go because they could improve their standard of living, not starve to death, and became involved in politics and rise as far as anyone else in the country did. But she also lamented that Ireland was hemorrhaging its best and brightest to the U.S. But she was a very practical woman. She knew that the Irish Americans had money and could help the cause of the liberation of Ireland.
Can I ask you, Kim, were you going to read another segment of the book for us?
Sure. An important lesson that Maud's Aunt Mary taught her impressionable teenage great-niece was that it didn't matter how ugly the men in her life were, but women must be beautiful. As she demonstrated in her own person in Paris, that took work. Under the tutelage of her aunt, Maud learned the importance of beauty and of good presentation of one's hair, makeup, and dress. More importantly, Maud, like her 70-year-old aunt, learned to use beauty to manipulate men and get them to do as she wanted. One of Maud's hobbies was launching beauties into European society. Introduced to the willowy teenager, the Countess realized Maud could be a great success in high society. She begged Tommy, Maud's father, to leave the girl in her care. However, while visiting her aunt on holiday in Hamburg, Germany, at a fashionable hotel, Maud attracted the attention of the Prince of Wales. Her delighted aunt expected an invitation to supper, but Tommy swooped in, took Maud away with him to the opera in Bayreuth. He batted away interested suitors because he felt she was too young to marry, nor did he want her to be a mistress, despite the Countess introducing Maud to the demi-monde in the person of her young secretary, and despite his letting the Countess train Maud in the arts of a courtesan in the city where such women were celebrated and memorialized in literature. The intelligent and the sophisticated among the beauties and the courtesans ran their own salons. On one of her memorable visits to Paris, Maud spent an afternoon with the Countess. On that storied visit, remembered 50 years later, Maud and her aunt took a drive in a carriage in the Bois de Boulogne. They went to the perfumer's where Aunt Mary advised her great niece, "You should always use the same perfume, one that suits you." Maud paid attention and used a recognizable perfume as an adult, so much so that this scent crept into one of her admirer's dreams. Next, Aunt Mary took Maud to a hat shop where she bought her grandniece a fashionable, large, black lace hat. Aunt Mary's was an education of a different sort than Mademoiselle's, her governess, one that Maud was to draw on for the rest of her life. No matter where she lived, Maud's clothes, and later the fabrics for the black dress and veil she habitually wore when she returned to Ireland in 1918, came from Paris.
Wow, that's beautiful. It's amazing, Kim, how, as you say, as you commented there earlier, and how, as you convey so well in the book, you get at her in the round in terms of going beyond this one-dimensional figure, and how on one hand she was this woman who was, you know, arguably ahead of her time and liberated and, you know, kind of like literally ahead of her time in terms of how she conducted herself or her worldview. And at the same time, we see her being influenced in these kind of very traditional ways in terms of, you know, expectations of how women of her standing would present themselves to the world and find suitors or not. It's really, she's you know, you draw her out in a very nuanced way.
Good.
Yeah. Can I ask you, Kim, it sounds like, judging by the epilogue of, The Fascination of What's Difficult, A Life of Maud Gonne, that you, I get the sense, if I'm understanding you correctly, that you feel like you've kind of, what would you say, you've put her to bed in terms of your fascination with her. Is that really, you know, you kind of, this was, this journey in terms of engaging with her began a long time ago, and then with the book and the culmination of it being out in the world, you really have that kind of sense of you've been there and done that, and you kind of can move on to other projects, as you mentioned.
Yes, I wanted it to read kind of like a mystery novel. Why does this young woman in California become fascinated with Maud Gonne, who was an Irish patriot? And by the end of, and I wanted to know what we had in common and didn't have in common, and what drove Maud. And I felt like I answered those questions by the end of the book in the epilogue, so that I could say, yes, this is done.
How has the, you know, in terms of it being out in the world, Kim, has anything in particular struck you about how people have engaged with it, or the topic, you know, is there anything that has, surprised you in terms of how people have read the book or engaged with your interpretation of Maud Gonne?
It's been mostly very favorable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I took a lot of time, and obviously it was 2 years of research, but I've been thinking about it for a while, and I made sure that the details were correct. Mm-hmm. I worked as a reporter at Fortune, and I was trained to fact check. Mm-hmm. So no one said, okay, she didn't do this then, there, you know, or argued with any of the interpretations. It's just, I find it the question of what makes a muse in the 20th century and the 21st fascinating. Like, will women continue to be muses as much, or will they use other people themselves when their artist is a muse?
Yeah, and the question you raise in terms of, like, expectations today in terms of how women present themselves, et cetera, et cetera. We see that all the time in terms of, you know, female politicians or leaders, and yeah. They're held to a different standard. So I guess it's kind of depressing in one sense to see the cyclical nature, and then interesting to see how her historical example can resonate today. Well, listen, Kim, I want to congratulate you again. It's a wonderful read. Again, for our listeners, it's called The Fascination of What's Difficult, A Life of Maud Gonne. It's published by OR Books. As I mentioned, we're speaking to its author, Kim Bendheim. Kim, thank you for coming on This Irish American Life to share the insights and to read from it. It's really been a pleasure, and I hope you stay safe and well.
Thank you. I want to put one more plug in. I had a conversation with Zadie Smith about muses and the changing role of muses in the 21st century, and we both think that a lot of progress has been made.
Oh, wow. Good. What a fascinating. I'd love to have been a fly on the wall for that conversation between the two of you. Sounds great. Thank you for sharing that, Kim. Not at all. Our pleasure. And best of luck with your future projects.
Thank you.
Welcome, Una, to the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour, and thanks for being willing to chat to us about some of the research you've been doing here over recent months. Will you tell us a little bit about what brought you to New York and to the research you're doing right now?
Okay, I will, of course, Mary. I'm always delighted to talk about my research, and really glad to be here, and thank you for the invitation. I'm looking at John Quinn, and that name should ring, I suppose, lots of bells in lots of ways in New York, because John Quinn was known as the man from New York in common parlance, coming somehow from Reed's book in 1968 when he called it John Quinn and His Friends, the man from New York. Quinn is a fascinating character in so many ways. I came across him years ago when I was doing my PhD. Now, that's a long time ago. When I was looking at the tour of Douglas Hyde in the United States, because, of course, John Quinn organized Hyde's tour in the United States in 1905-06. And he had done the same for W.B. Yeats in 1903, and became very well known as a supporter of Irish causes. He was an Irish-American. He was born in Tiffin, Ohio in 1870. His father was a baker, but actually it was his mother, as sometimes they do, who influenced him hugely in betting his allowance, for example, on the presidential election. And it was both she and his teacher who encouraged his interest in first edition books, and he tended to spend a lot of his money on that, or his pocket money on it, when he was younger. And in some ways, I suppose, coming from Tiffin, Ohio, you certainly wouldn't associate him with New York in any way. But he went for a year to the University of Michigan, and again, his mother sort of intervened, because her friend Charles Foster became Secretary of the Treasury under Harrison. And he asked John Quinn to go to Washington with him as his secretary, and he did. And while he was there, he went to Georgetown to study law, and went from Georgetown to Harvard to do international law, and left Harvard to go to New York and with the firm of Benjamin Tracy, and never left New York until he died in 1924. So he makes this trip, I suppose, through Washington, Harvard, and into New York, and really, really focuses on the East Coast from then on. Very, very much promotes I suppose that New York-Washington axis. But is involved, I suppose, in the Democratic Party to some extent, very friendly with Underwood, who's beaten by Wilson for the presidential nomination in 1912, very upset by that, in fact, Quinn was. So he's quite involved initially in Democratic politics, knows Cohalan, knows of Devoy and has met Devoy, but never very friendly with Devoy, for example. But becomes really, really interested as an Irish American in cultural Ireland. And one of the things, as I say, he begins by doing is going to Ireland, meeting Yeats, providing a base for Yeats to go on his lecture tour, and organising cultural, as he put it, culturally aware Irish Americans to come to his lectures, and he does the same for Douglas Hyde. In some ways, I suppose this gives him a reputation amongst the Irish as a rich man. He's a lawyer, he has a nice apartment, he's interested in Ireland, he has been to Ireland. He buys first editions of things. He gets involved with Irish writers. He gets involved with Irish playwrights. And he comes to bitterly resent his reputation amongst the Irish as a rich man and as a supporter of Irish causes. But in 1903, 1905, 1906, that's still a little way in the future. But he is definitely regarded by the Irish as a good person to have on their side, particularly culturally. And I suppose that starts his foray in some ways into what I'm looking at, and I'm eventually getting to that, which is his focus on art. Because a lot of people have written about John Quinn, aside from Reed and The Man from New York. The Laundrevilles have written about his library, for example, which he had a huge collection of books. His letters to Mae Morris in England were published. His letters with Maud Gonne have been published. They've been the subject of scholarly articles. He also has been the subject of scholarly articles on his defence of the publication of Ulysses in the Little Review here in New York. And Colin Tobin, of course, has written about him and his affair with Lady Gregory in Lady Gregory's Toothbrush. So John Quinn is a mixture of lots of things. And in some ways, therefore, it's kind of hard to get, you think you know him, but it's hard to get a handle on him because he's involved in so many things. And I suppose my focus on him is on his art collection. Because a lot of the time when I was looking at Irish America and sort of Irish American identity, particularly in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, I went to the newspapers, I went to the Gaelic American, I went to the Irish World, I went to lots of local newspapers to see, for example, what the Irish were thinking, what they were reading, what was being written about them, how they were connecting with home, how they were connecting with each other in America. But what's really interesting about John Quinn, and I suppose he gives us an insight into a world which is not that world which I had assumed was sort of the collective Irish American experience, is that he is interested in Irish things, but he's also interested in lots of other things as well. He's very, very focused on his life in New York, and nobody really has looked at him as a lawyer, at the cases he has taken, at his compatriots, and also some of whom are Irish, like Vincent Dowling, like James Byrne, within the New York Bar Association, who are all lawyers, but also his relationships with legislators in Washington, for example, and the judges he comes up against in New York in various cases. And that's a really interesting part of his background, and that comes out in some ways through his letters. And the other thing, I suppose, that in some ways is missing is we look at him as a cultural icon, but the fact of him being culturally aware and culturally significant in New York rather than in Irish American affairs is, I suppose, something that I'm interested in as well. And one of the things that jumps out hugely is John Quinn's involvement in the Armory Show in 1913, because the Armory Show is this huge, significant dot on the modern art calendar of the United States. It's the first modern art avant-garde show in the United States, hugely celebrated, in fact, big, well celebrated in 2013 also, and of course the Armory still stands. And John Quinn at the time was the lawyer for the American Artists and Sculptors Association, and very friendly with Walt Kuhn and Arthur Davies, two great American painters who really organized the Armory show. And John Quinn lent a lot of his works to the Armory show, particularly his Augustus John paintings, and he opened the show and went every single day to the show, wrote to everybody about the show, talked about it. And he has therefore this, I suppose, this central role in the changing of an art focus in New York and in the United States to, I suppose, from the post-impressionists into the new cubistic work, into the futurists, and into modern contemporary art at the time. And interestingly, since I've been in New York since January, the Met had the Lauder exhibition, the Neue Gallery also had Schiele, although of course that was the that was German art, and John Quinn didn't really like German art, but I'll come to that in a minute. And at the moment in the Guggenheim, in the Tannhauser exhibition, in the collection there, you can see the kinds of people that Quinn was collecting. And here, a whole century later, you're still looking at these works as key works of a particular era. Now, let me put on the table straight away here. I'm not an art historian. I'm not looking at this in an art history way. I'm looking at Quinn, I suppose, as a particular type of Irish American, and not as the kind of Irish Americans maybe that I had been looking at heretofore, like those who were writing for or contributing to the newspapers. He's definitely wealthy, but he says he works for his money, and this I think is the other thing that comes out of a lot of the letters that he has, that he leaves, is that he is constantly driven. Every single letter begins with, I'm so driven, I'm so busy, my partner in the office has just left, my stenographer is causing trouble, my boy has lost all my work, and I'm driven so much. So he's constantly working. In fact, during World War One, he says he would like to have joined with the Red Cross, but he just couldn't leave his business, because if he left his business it would disappear and he wouldn't be able to actually, you know, he wouldn't have any money at that point in time. So even though he has a reputation as somebody who's very rich and wealthy, nonetheless this is hard earned. This money is very hard earned. So there is a sense that he is he's a wealthy, professional, middle class Irish American, and the coterie around him are the same kind, even though he puts others on a different plane to himself. He says some are wealthier, some are some have a much more indolent lifestyle than he has. So from that point of view, that aspect of him is important. But also I think he is a power broker of certain in a certain way, because Quinn, and I just take from the point of view of art, because that's what I'll be looking at, I suppose, really in more detail. Who were the important figures in art at this time? And he actually himself writes a letter to one of the Rosenbergs in France, and they ask John Quinn, who are the people to whom we should send our catalogues? So the Rosenbergs are dealing in modern, cubistic, contemporary French art. And they ask John Quinn, who should they send their photographs to? And John Quinn writes them back this long letter to Paul and Leon Rosenberg and says, well, you shouldn't send it to this person, they'll throw your pictures out the window, maybe to this person because, you know, they're a buyer of certain kinds of art, because he was buying that kind of art at the time. And he's able to give a list of all the other collectors in New York at the time. So there's a certain grouping of whom I suppose John Quinn is a member, and it's not something that you normally associate, I think, with Irish Americans at that time. The other thing I think that's interesting about him is that during World War One, John Quinn is vehemently pro-ally. He takes it almost personally that France is being attacked and that the Germans are lethal for the civilization of Europe. And what's interesting, I suppose, is that he decides that he cannot go on Red Cross work or that he cannot go and join the army. He actually gets cancer in 1918 as well, and he's laid up for a long time. But he decides to try and help the Allies in a particular way. First he buys British art, and then he buys particularly French art of artists who are at the front. The Seguinsac, the Villon brothers, for example, of whom Marcel Duchamp is one. Dufresne is another. Rouault is another. He buys their work. He sends them cash. He sends their widows or their mothers money for their paintings. And this he sees as a focus on the war, that he will help French artists during the war, particularly those at the front, as in doing his bit for France. And after, in 1919, the French government actually gives him the Legion of Honour in recognition of his help for the French artists during the war. And John Quinn likes telling everybody about, you know, how he did this, and he writes it in so many letters how proud he was that he did this. And I suppose in some ways the way we know about Quinn can be in its own way problematic, maybe, because of course he left letters. His papers and his letters have an interesting story to them in themselves. He died in 1924 of cancer of the liver, and left all his papers to Jeanie Robert Foster, who was his great friend at the time, possibly his lover. We don't know, but the reality of it, they were great companions, and they were in France together, collecting art together, spending a lot of time together. And he left the curation of his papers to her, and they were really, I suppose, kept for a long time. They were given to the New York Public Library. A selection were given to the New York Public Library, and some of them were released in the 1950s, but under restriction. And then in, I suppose, 1962, really, what happened was his niece actually gave the whole collection, without restriction, opened the whole collection to the New York Public Library. So you have a whole series of things that are there. You have letter books, all the letters he ever wrote, all typed and collected. A lot of the letters which he actually received, all there as well. You have ledgers in which all his art purchases are, in which his first edition books are. He sold his library in the early 1920s and 1922 to pay for art, and lost a lot of money on it. He had first editions of Conrad, first editions of Joyce, of Pound, of Ford Madox Ford. He had a huge collection of first edition works, but he sold them all, and as I say, to concentrate on his art purchases. And all the ledgers are there, so you have a sense of a life that's actually there. And I think what's interesting about the art is, in the art ledgers you have what he bought, what he spent on it, what artists he was buying from, what descriptions of the pictures that he actually bought. And the other thing I think that's interesting is you have in those ledgers, you have the other things he bought: a grand piano from Steinway, X from Tiffany, pictures, furniture, knickknacks for the house and his apartment on Central Park West. So you have, I think, all of these things that are in the ledger. So you have a sense of a life that's quite complete in some ways when you actually look at these. So in that sense, I suppose, you can see his version of himself in the letters he writes to others. And their letters to him also give a sense of that communication back and forth. Now, as you know, it's really, really difficult to just look at letters and say, okay, let's find out about this person. In fact, Reid in his biography says, I'm going to write what I know, not what I can surmise. Because especially if you're a biographer, you can get caught up in liking the man, in sometimes maybe not liking what he says, but nonetheless, you can actually get caught up in a life, in the mind of somebody else. And I suppose to guard against that in some ways, you're trying to read around certain things so that you're looking at it and saying, I think Stanley is the says that in the letters you have a world that's taken for granted between the two. And in some ways, in trying to get into that world, what's taken for granted? Where does he hang out? Where does he walk every single day? So in New York, he has an apartment on 58 Central Park West. It's the final apartment that he moves to. And his work is in Nassau Street. His office is in Nassau Street, in the financial district, or I suppose down near Chambers Street. So he walks a lot of that every single day. So you have that sense of him walking down the streets of New York from Central Park West. The places that he goes to, the coffee club, the Manhattan Club, the Majestic Hotel, which he describes in a letter to Augustus John, of drinking highballs on the roof of the Majestic in the middle of one summer when it's really, really hot. And they're there till 2 a.m. in the morning with his friends Honecker and Greg. And, you know, there's a sense of a life being lived in this whole, in the letters, which are almost not mentioned. You know, they're the commonplaces. They're things that they're taking for granted. The places that he goes to, that he drives up, he motors up to Sleepy Hollow Club, that he goes out to White Plains, that he goes out to the country, that he camps in New Jersey in an old army tent, which, mind you, has a bed in it, at various times. And so there are things of a lifestyle that you see in these letters as well as I suppose what I'm looking at, who he's writing to, what dealers he's talking about as well. So that part I think is really fascinating, to see who he's with, who he's talking to, what he's writing about, what he's going to, what he's spending his money on. In some of the cases that he talks about, that the art comes in, he said, I also brought back fur gloves and overcoats and hats for friends of mine who are actually here in the United States. And this is like from a trip to Ireland and London in 1911 or something like that. So again, you can see the kinds of things he's bringing back in. And again, they're almost asides in the letters that he's talking about. So in some ways, I suppose, what you see is a man who is a New Yorker, an American, and yet who says, we Irish must do X, Y, or Z. He says, I say we Irish because I've never fully been able to call myself an American. And it's a very strange thing for a man who exhibits, I suppose, a lot of the characteristics of being American at the time. Connections, a lifestyle, a pace of life, an engagement with American life and particularly law cases. So to try and divorce him from that sense of Americanness that he's describing as natural and put him then into a sort of an Irish American focus, which maybe sometimes it's forgotten about, because when we look at Irish Americans, we're thinking of them in the context almost of this dual consciousness of Ireland and America. And when, particularly from 1912, I think, on, really doesn't have that connection to Ireland that he had before. He never goes to Ireland again after 1911. He never visits Ireland again. He goes to what he calls the other side, but he goes to England or he goes to France. And actually, he mostly goes to France when he goes abroad. The four or five times that he goes after 1912, he goes to France and not to Ireland. He never visits Ireland again. And I think from that point of view, even when things like the war breaks out, he thinks the Irish should, he supports John Redmond initially. Then he thinks Redmond lost it and should have armed the volunteers in opposition to Carson. But when 1916 breaks out, he calls them asses. He says they're sentimental asses. It was always going to fail. Why did they get involved with this? With Redmond, half a loaf was better than none, and in fact the Irish should have agreed to conscription. Then the British had the executions, and he is so disgusted with the executions of 1916, and of course with Casement, because Casement in some ways becomes a focal point for Quinn, because Quinn himself, I suppose, looks at Casement as a friend, even though he thinks he's quite mad, and doesn't support his foray into Germany in any shape or form. But when the British begin to drum up all the charges against Casement, particularly the charges of indecency and homosexuality, Quinn goes and writes this support for Casement. And really, while he's very anti-German and very anti what happened in 1916, he really doesn't believe that he's been treated well, and believes that the execution and the hanging of Casement in particular is a real problem, and very, very wrong, morally wrong, and wrong in politically, strategically, in every way. But after that, he still doesn't want Sinn Féin to gain any credence within, even though he talks about Ireland as something which really he's only interested in the context of war at this point in time, and as part of an empire. And interestingly, at that point he comes along and he says, okay, let's get involved in Home Rule, and he gets involved with Horace Plunkett and with AE, and writes a pamphlet on a version of Dominion status with Home Rule. It gets nowhere, of course, but nonetheless he's involved with Ireland in ways because of his connections, because of his friendships, particularly with the likes of George W. Russell AE, with particularly with the likes of Maud Gonne, for example. So because of connections, because of interest, because of, in some ways, a real sense of integrity and a real sense of being principled, Quinn gets involved in certain things. But his interest, I suppose, isn't as much in Ireland as it was in the years 1902 to 1912. His interest becomes very focused on the war, and his interest becomes very focused on France. For example, in 1917, he gives the Lafayette Day address in Union Square, and talks about how loyal Irish Americans are to the cause of France. And this is in September, I suppose, 1917. The United States have just entered the war. And when Shane Leslie, who's a friend of his, and of course an Irishman, writes to him and says, okay, I'm going to write a little bit about Irish Americans in the United States because I think this is an important thing to write about. And he sends him a draft of his article on Irish America, I suppose during the period of the war and after. And John Quinn corrects it. And he says, you know, he said, when you think of Devoy, Cohalan and that group, he said, the pro-Germans, the focus on this pro-German aspect of Irish America, he said, they don't represent Irish Americans. 99% of Irish Americans are loyal to the Allies. They're loyal to America. And they're supportive of France. They're supportive of the Allied cause. Now, where Quinn was getting his 99% is another question. But what it is, I suppose, he's providing a counterpoint to the accepted idea of race conventions, of Irish America at a particular time. And if you watch the trajectory of Quinn's letters, he almost, aside from his friendships and connections, and his interest, almost in a cerebral way, to Ireland at that time, he talks as an American. And he talks as an Irish American, but not an Irish American that we almost take for granted. And I think that's an interesting thing about him. And while I'm looking at his art and I'm looking at his attitudes to what he's buying and how he's a broker of influence and how he's, I suppose, very much a modern person in his own way. I think these bring around characteristics as well, which is very telling. He talks about going into the armory show and he says, I like to be a man of my own time. I don't want to focus on the past. It gives me a thrill because these artists are living and the old masters are dead. So there's a sense of being a person who's living in the moment, who's contemporary, who's new, who's of New York, who's of the up-and-coming America at the time. And he sees himself very much as part and parcel of that. And even though maybe he talks of himself as Irish, what he's bringing out, I think, is almost an American characteristic, and you see that in his letters. But more importantly, there's a democratic republicanness in his thinking, because he says, why should J.P. Morgan, for example, be able to buy up all the old masters and keep them in Europe until the tax comes off art? What Quinn does is he goes to Washington three times, 1913, 1918, 1922, to take the import duty off art, contemporary art, to reduce the tax on art to 10%, and eventually to keep it down in 1922. And he does that because of his knowledge of Washington. He talks before the House Ways and Means Committee. He argues the case because he's a lawyer. And he succeeds each time in having the duty removed from modern art. Now, some of that is selfish because he's bringing in a lot of art, and of course he doesn't want to spend the duty. But at the same time, he talks about the notion that it's only for rich men who buy old masters that you have this old art. Whereas this new contemporary art, anyone should be able to buy it. And we shouldn't have to pay duty on it. It's not a luxury. It's not something that actually is, that's only for rich people. It should be for everyone. He tries to get the Metropolitan to open free on particular days so that people can go in and see the paintings in the Met. Ordinary people, as he looks at himself as, I suppose. So there's this sense of a democratic principle also in his thinking, that access to culture is important for civilization. He writes a pamphlet about the duty on art, and he says, we might as well tax philosophy, we might as well tax literature if we're going to tax art, so why shouldn't ordinary people have access to art? And so that underlines, and I suppose is a foundation for a lot of the way he's thinking, and in some ways I think that's also a very American principle as well. Even though he's saying at the same time, why should Ireland be a republic? There's no glamour in an Irish republic for me. I would rather have Ireland as part of the empire. And that, even in 1923, is interesting, and he has no time for De Valera. Wants De Valera to be shot, calls him that he's a sore loser during the Civil War, and says that he is a vindictive, dangerous, sinister man, and he's not even an Irishman. And so you have all these contradictions, I suppose, in Quinn.
We're coming towards the end of the programme. I'm Dr. Miriam Knighton Gray, and I'd like to thank you for listening to This Irish American Life, coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radio hour. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to our website at www.nyuirish.net/radio hour. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Remember that next week we will be back, same time, same place. We are always very happy to have you here on This Irish American Life, and thank you for being with us for another week. Slán agus beannacht. Our theme music today is the opening set by The Gloaming, produced by Brassland and Real World Records. And this broadcast of Irish Radio Hour from Luxman Ireland House, NYU, was paid for by Luxman Ireland House, NYU, in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited.